keep calm and carry on today on The World.
The big question is this moment just a correction or is something bigger?
Yeah, that is the big question. After stock market volatility has analysts in the U.S. and across the globe scratching their heads, we'll get the view from London, where one trader's advice is to keep calm and carry on. Plus, 100 years ago today, some women in the U.K. first won the right to vote. We remember what it took to get there.
At exactly 5:30, one memorable evening, relays of women produced hammers from their muffs and handbags and proceeded methodically to smash shop windows in all the big London thoroughfares.
Those stories and much more today on The World. I'm Marco Werman, and you're tuned to The World. It's good to have you with us. We start with the stock market. I know, volatile seems too polite a word for it, and yet terrifying puts in mind Kevin Bacon's character in Animal House.
Remain calm! All is well! All is well!
That encouraging mix of reason and extreme doubt. True, nerves are frayed, but let's keep things in perspective here. Historically, this correction doesn't make the top 20 plunges in the market by percentage, and we keep hearing that the U.S. economy is strong. It's also interconnected with economies and markets all over the world. So we start today with what the unease on Wall Street looks like from another market. Carlo Alberto De Casa is chief analyst of UK-based online broker Active Trades.
The big question is this moment just a correction or is something bigger? So far, at least in Europe, the opinion that we have is that this is still a correction. It's not yet a panic selling or a crash.
Yeah, so your advice is the advice we see in the London Tube. Keep calm and carry on. Is that it?
Yeah, kind of, yes. Of course, I would say there's still not time for panic. This is not another 2007, 2008. At least so far, we are not talking about a crisis. We are talking about an important correction. And the fact is that the general feeling that we have is that the global economy is still performing well.
I'm curious to hear from you, Carlo, when it comes to the global economy, is what happens to U.S. markets and the U.S. economy more important than what happens in other markets?
Of course. In this scenario, yes. And now I think that if U.S. indices are going to show a correction, all other indices could follow. Of course, the proportion of the correction could change from the different countries and different local scenario. But I would say that the general direction is still given by U.S. indices.
So, Carlo, I know you were quoted in The Guardian saying this might be the end of the honeymoon between Donald Trump and the markets. The markets kind of began 2017 hoping for some signs from Washington that Trump and Congress could get stuff done, and so far only a tax cut that remains pretty controversial. How much do you as a trader pay attention to the politics in Washington right now?
Of course, a lot. Of course, paying a lot of attention to the politics, starting from UK with Brexit story and Europe as well. But US is central. Basically, I would say that after an initial phase of confusion, the first few hours after Donald Trump election, the reaction of the market was relatively good, as we saw an important bullish trend in the last 15 months. Now, the fact is that markets are asking for something more. And what is scaring markets now is the fact that there could be a growing possibility of seeing interest in rates going up, and this could happen quicker than expected. So I would say Trump's decisions are important, but even more we are paying attention to what is doing the Federal Reserve.
Carlo Alberto De Casa with Active Trades in London. Thanks very much.
Thank you very much.
If volatile has the biggest font in the word cloud of economics right now, treason has a pretty big font in the political word cloud. Treason is the crime of betraying one's country. Sounds simple, but is it? In a speech yesterday, Donald Trump agreed with the idea that Democratic congressmen committed treason for failing to applaud key parts of his State of the Union address last week. A White House spokesman says he was joking, but treason is no joke. The penalty is death. Even conservative commentators like Bill Kristol have said Trump's use of the term is a disgrace. Carlton Larson is a professor of law at the University of California, Davis. Just start us off here. What is treason? What is the definition?
Well, treason is different in each country around the world, but in the United States, it's defined explicitly in our Constitution as either levying war against the United States or adhering to their enemies, giving them aid and comfort.
Technically, weren't the Founding Fathers guilty of treason when they rebelled against Great Britain?
Yes, absolutely. All of them had committed treason against Great Britain. They were levying war against the king, and Britain viewed them as such. They insisted that these people were traitors, but ultimately, of course, the Americans won, and when you win, the taint of treason goes away.
And yet treason is mentioned 8 times in the U.S. Constitution, so it was clearly contemplated as a serious thing by the Founding Fathers. Talk about that. Why was that?
Well, it's one of those crimes, unlike most other crimes, you know, so if you think property crimes or violent crimes, this is a crime that arises political passions. And it's very easy for people to confuse disagreement with the government with outright treason and disloyalty. That's been a problem throughout human history. How do you get with so-called, you know, loyal opposition? To what extent can you have people who are bitterly opposed to the government, but at the same time are not actually traitors? And the framers of the Constitution were aware of that problem. They had thought about it a lot, and they realized that when you empower the government to punish people for treason just on the basis of perceived disloyalty or political disagreement, that that's a tool in the hands of government that we simply don't want to see there.
So how has the law on treason been applied since the writing of the Constitution?
There haven't been all that many cases. There have been a handful of cases that have been brought through to conviction. No person has been executed under the United States Constitution for the crime of treason, which is rather remarkable given that you're talking about, you know, about a 230-year history without an execution, which isn't to say that treason hasn't been committed. The Civil War, for example, was a significant act of treason by people levying war against the United States, but no person was ever executed for that.
So Julius and Ethel Rosenberg, sentenced to death and did die in the electric chair. That was a case of conspiracy to commit espionage. But why wasn't treason invoked there?
It's interesting. The presiding judge used the term treason when sentencing them. The prosecutor used the term. But technically, it wasn't treason because what they had done was hand nuclear secrets over to the Soviet Union. And the Soviet Union at the time was formally not an enemy of the United States because we hadn't declared war against the Soviet Union, and we weren't at open war with the Soviet Union either. Therefore, a treason charge couldn't legally be brought against the Rosenbergs, and so he had to use the next best thing, which was conspiracy to commit espionage.
And the reason today presidents don't just kind of like bandy it about because it is such a potent word?
Well, yeah. I mean, if a president is, you know, head of the federal government, and it's the federal government that ultimately has the ability to bring charges for treason, and so if a president says that, it's sort of a signal to his Justice Department that this is something you should do. Now, I don't think Trump meant it in that serious a sense. I think it was sort of a throwaway comment, but it's still an unhelpful and particularly nasty throwaway comment because you're using it to accuse your political enemies of essentially the worst crime known to the law.
A few opponents, we should say, of Trump have also used the term treason in relation to the Trump campaign's dealings with Russia. But is it possible to imagine those exchanges amounting to providing, as the law says, aid and comfort to America's enemies?
No, I don't think so. The extent that anything was done, if it was done in coordination with Russia, you have the same problem as with the Rosenbergs, that Russia is not technically an enemy. We are not at war with Russia. And so even though they did things that were extraordinarily harmful to the United States, that alone doesn't make for a case of treason.
Carlton Larson, professor of law at UC Davis, thanks very much for explaining this to us.
Oh, you're very welcome.
He's not a name many of us know, Esmond Martin, but for African wildlife, he was very important. An American conservationist and ivory trade investigator who lived in Kenya, Martin was found stabbed to death in his Nairobi home this week. 4 suspects have been arrested in connection with the murder. Kenyans are in shock.
He was not just an asset for Kenya. He was an asset for pachyderms wherever they were, elephants and rhinos.
That's Kenyan Paula Kahumbu. She leads the conservation group Wildlife Direct, and she worked closely with Martin. Kahumbu says Esmond Martin was relentless in his pursuit of illegally traded ivory and rhino horn.
So he went into places where these things were happening very openly in markets. For example, in China and Hong Kong, where ivory is simply being sold openly in shops because it was legal. But it was also being sold openly in markets like in places like Angola or Congo. He observed who was buying it and the prices. And he exposed a lot of things that nobody knew, you know, where the rhino horn was going. For example, he's the one who revealed years and years ago that they were being turned into handles on these daggers in Yemen. And this really altered our perceptions about how to deal with some of these challenges. He recently did a lot of work around Asia, especially China, Vietnam, Laos, recently Myanmar. And he was trying to understand how the international agreements were translating into actions on the ground in terms of factories where they were carving ivory or shops where ivory was being retailed. He wanted to understand what was happening to the prices of the items, what kind of items were being carved, the size of those items, in order to really understand how those markets were behaving and what was happening with the demand.
It was hard to miss this man, considering he was investigating stuff underground, and he stood out for a number of reasons. What did he look like?
Well, Esmond never tried to conceal his identity. He was an extremely tall man. I think he was over 6 foot. He had a big shock of white hair, so everybody knew him. Mm. He was stood out wherever he went, especially in Asia. From what I know, he never tried to conceal what he was doing. He would openly go into shops, ask questions, take photographs, gather data. And he believed that people were very open to him because he was honest about what he was doing. He wasn't carrying hidden cameras or anything like that.
We're talking ivory and rhino horn. It's a multi-million dollar business. Was he ever concerned about the risks he was running investigating it?
He must have known when there were risks and where the risks were. He went into places where the actual shopkeepers and sellers didn't really give a toss about global matters. You know, they were just selling stuff, you know, in the stores and in streets. The most prominent thing he would do is report on the scale of the ivory. For example, in the United States, he reported that the scale of ivory trade, illegal ivory trade in the USA, was second only to China. And that led Americans to rethink their position and their moral authority on these issues. And it led to clamping down. It led the US Fish and Wildlife Service to take radical action to shut down the illegal market. I imagine that when he went into the major Chinese factories, they might have been a little bit more cautious, but he was never threatening. He's not somebody who caused anybody to go to jail. That wasn't his work. His work was just to document what was happening. And that information was then taken up by many other agencies to justify their lobbying positions at the international conventions like CITES, and also to push their own governments to do a better job.
And CITES, that's the International Convention on Endangered Species, correct?
It's the Convention on International Trade in Endangered Species, yes.
Yeah, that network of conservationists and the international community understand what his loss means. What about the average Kenyan? Are wildlife and wildlife concerns relevant to them?
Kenya has a surprisingly strong public attachment to wildlife. We have a very, very important tourism industry, so already people feel there's an economic benefit to wildlife. But recently, we've started showing a lot of wildlife documentaries, and the general public attitude towards wildlife is very, very positive, and we've shown this through surveys. When people read what we've written about Esmond and what he did, there is this real sense of loss for the nation and for our wildlife.
Paula Kehumbo, a Kenyan conservationist who worked closely with Esmond Martin, helping us remember this man. Thanks very much, Paula.
Thank you.
Just ahead, 100 years of women's suffrage in the UK. You're with the world. I'm Marco Werman. You're with the world. Our friends at the BBC program Witness dub it History is Told by the People Who Were There, which means when we hear from Witness, it often takes us back in time, as in this story, which marks an important moment. 100 years ago today, women, at least some of them, were given the right to vote in Britain. It came after decades of marches and strikes by those female campaigners known as suffragettes. Here's my BBC colleague, Louise Hidalgo.
It was in February 1918 that Parliament in Britain passed the Representation of the People Act, giving all men over the age of 21 and all property-owning women over 30 the right to vote. The The March of the Women was the battle song of the suffragettes, a militant band of women led by Emmeline Pankhurst, who in the years before 1918 had waged a war of civil disobedience to get women the vote. Dame Ethel Smythe, who composed the anthem, later recalled the early days of protest.
At exactly 5:30 one memorable evening in 1912, relays of women produced hammers from their muffs and handbags and proceeded methodically to smash shop windows in all the big London thoroughfares, Piccadilly, Regent Street, and so on, inspired by the knowledge that exactly at that moment, Mrs. Pankhurst was opening the ball with a stone aimed at a window of 10 Downing Street.
The suffragettes had launched their campaign at a time when it was unthinkable that a woman could vote, let alone be elected to Parliament, as the politician Shirley Williams, the daughter of an early feminist, was to be 40 years later.
The Pankhurst movement, which of course was called the suffragette movement, was prepared to never act violently against other human beings, but certainly to do things like putting flaming torches into postboxes, breaking windows, occasionally even going so far as one Emily Davidson did, who threw herself before the king's horse in order to make her point and was, of course, killed.
Fellow suffragette Mary Richardson was there when Emily Davidson leapt under the horse.
I was standing just nearby selling the newspaper. I saw it happen. I don't know if she simply darted under the rails at Tatnam Corner, got to the king's horse and brought it on the knees, and the next I saw she was lying in the middle of the course and people rushing out at her, tearing off her clothes. The police rescued her. Then a man came and bashed me in the face very sweetly and charmingly, and then I ran for all I was worth across the downs and got trained back to Waterloo.
Emily Davison had made the supreme sacrifice for the cause of women's suffrage. But many other campaigners suffered too. They were thrown into jail for their vandalism, and many went on hunger strike.
Suffragettes were prepared to adopt civil violence, but in doing so, they almost invariably allowed the violence to repercuss on themselves. But they certainly got a lot of publicity, a lot of cover and the press, and the most brutal treatment. For example, one of the key things was that they used to be fed forcefully because they would go on hunger strike in order to get out of prison. And force feeding, which involves putting a hose down somebody's throat, is a very brutal and very painful response to that, a form of torture, really.
The memories of being force-fed were to stay with Mary Richardson for the rest of her life.
They fed me through my nose, which was very painful because the nose swells with the tubes. They used to throw me on the floor, cover me with a sheet, and then I'd have about three wardresses, huge heavy weights lying across my body to hold me down. And then the doctors would come in, one kneel on my shoulder and the other one would put the tube up my nose. Great long tube with a very stiff end. It affects your eyes as well as hurting your nose. And I sometimes used to think I couldn't stand it anymore, that with the solitary confinement. I don't know, I got help from outside in some sort of way and I just managed to hold on.
The last thing that the government of the day wanted was that these women should die in jail. And so they devised what became known as the Cat and Mouse Act. The suffragette leader, Emmeline Pankhurst, was among its targets. So was her daughter, Sylvia, talking later here.
The government, to compel the suffragette hunger strikers to serve their sentences to the bitter end, had enacted the Cat and Mouse Act, by which, on nearing the point of death, hunger strikers were released on brief license to recover among their friends, then rearrested. The currency of the sentence was suspended in the meantime. All this involved a terrible ordeal for the prisoner, as I fully know, having myself endured it 13 times in less than a year. In the course of 10 hunger, thirst, and sleep strikes, my mother served 6 weeks of the 3 years' penal servitude. She suffered acutely in prison. Her challenge was now, they must give us liberty or give us death.
The suffragettes' campaign was overtaken by events in 1914, when the First World War engulfed Europe. Shirley Williams believes it was those 4 years of war that finally forced the British government to give women the vote.
One has to simply look at the scale of the calling up of men in the First World War, the fact that once conscription came in, virtually every young man or man between the ages of 17 and 47 was liable to be called up. And that simply meant literally hundreds of thousands of jobs unfilled, which had to be filled and could only be filled by women. And that was the factor that finally dented the attitude of the establishment, which up to then had been consistently very negative, except for the Labour Party, which had been born and was coming into full fruition by 1918. But both the Liberals and the Conservatives were very, very hostile to the women's suffrage.
Society as a whole seemed to be as well, didn't it? I mean, I think that there have been some archives recently unearthed that showed that they were spied upon. They were regarded as sort of one of, if not the biggest threat to the British state at that time.
Funnily enough,
was there that deep fear?
Well, they were almost regarded as terrorists. My father's mother, who was called Edith Catlin, was married to my grandfather, and he was a vicar in the Church of England. And what was very striking was that when she became a strong supporter of the suffragist movement, the constitutional one, not the violent one, he found it almost impossible to get a living. Parish councils up and down the land would simply not accept the idea of a vicar, however capable he might be, who was married to a woman who supported the women's vote. So it was really regarded as a completely antisocial thing to be or to do. You were really regarded as both irresponsible and almost indecent.
Britain then was still a deeply traditional society, as Shirley Williams' own mother, Vera Britton, later recalled.
Provincial towns were more isolated than they are today. The whole household and his acquaintances were quite horrified by the news that I wanted to go to the university. For in those days, a girl who trained her mind was still thought to be endangering her matrimonial prospects. My mother was severely reproved by a feminine leader of local opinion. How can you send your daughter to college, she was asked. Don't you want her ever to get married?
But Vera Britton did marry. She also got a degree from Oxford University. Her daughter, Shirley Williams, would go on not only to become a Member of Parliament, but also a government minister. Emmeline Pankhurst died in 1928, the same year that all women in Britain, not just those over the age of 30, were given the right to vote.
The BBC's Louise Hidalgo there for the BBC's Witness programme. I'm Marco Werman. Homophobia is on the rise in Haiti, so being out and visible there is a tough choice. But for some Haitians, it's the only choice.
We have a proverb in this country. If you say hello to the devil, he'll eat you. And if you don't say hello to the devil, he'll eat you. So we decided to say hello to the devil.
That story still ahead here on The World. I'm Marco Werman, and this is The World. We're a co-production of the BBC World Service, PRI, and WGBH here in Boston. Barely into the second month of the year, and 2018 is already proving to be a busy one for migration in the Mediterranean. There's good news and bad on this front. More than 4,000 migrants have arrived on Italian shores since January 1st, and more than 300 have drowned en route to Europe from North Africa. On the other hand, the good news, if you can call it that, is that the numbers are high, but lower than this time last year. Some attribute this decline to an agreement between Italy and Libya a year ago that promised to help the Libyan Coast Guard intercept boats and bring migrants back to Libya. Leonard Doyle is a spokesperson for the International Organization for Migration. I asked him if he thought the decline in sea arrivals and deaths at sea are because of the agreement.
Look, I think it's a combination of things. There's been a concerted effort led by the European Union, members of it in particular, to try and get their hands around this huge flow of migrants coming into Europe. I mean, they managed to effectively stop the refugees, primarily refugees, who were coming in from Turkey into Greece. That was all over the media, and you had a million of them or more or less arriving in Germany 2 years ago. But they've never managed to stop the Libyan ones, because Libya is a much more difficult nut to crack, because there are many actors there, and many of them very, very, very nasty pieces. So, for example, you have ISIS in the south of the country. You have militias and smugglers for whom, you know, the economy is trading and trafficking and exploiting human beings, in particular these African migrants and others trying to come through. You have a very weak government. In fact, you have two rival weak governments. So into this whole mix, you have a lot of room for mischief, and the migrants simply just get exploited in this kind of terrible murder machine.
All right, so the drownings have slowed down, but the migrants are in Libya, and Amnesty International has come out against the agreement between Libya and Italy. basically saying migrants were being returned to these horrific conditions. So your organization, the IOM, works with the Libyan Coast Guard. Do you agree with Amnesty?
Look, we certainly applaud their interest in it, and we are hugely interested and motivated by the human rights of the migrants who are there. What we're trying to do is ensure that the Libyan Coast Guard behave better and are trained and have the right equipment. We certainly don't agree with people being put into detention. And in fact, following the report of the account of open slave markets in Libya, which the UN Migration Agency, IOM, broke that story, and then CNN, of course, took it to another level with their videography. But that has kind of broken the logjam in many ways, because the European Union is now spending vast amount of money to help us take people out of detention and home. So things are changing, but at the end of the day, you ask, are the smugglers the main beneficiaries? And they seem to continue to be benefiting.
And we're also hearing that the smugglers and the people who are running these detention centers in Libya often are working hand in glove and sometimes are the same people. Is that true?
That's open to interpretation, but it's very difficult for us to come out and say it, because what happens when our staff leave the detention centers and the doors are closed, we don't really know. But we find very credible many of the accounts of torture, abuse, all of that. Nobody's disbelieving it for a second. But we have to work in trying to improve the conditions that are there. We have to try and make sure that women are separated from the men, that there are hygienic facilities, and that above all, people are given the opportunity to come home. Because at the end of the day, they wanted a better life, all of these people. None of them wanted to end up in detention in Libya, and they've done nothing wrong beyond seeking a better life. But through a combination of being lured, across social media and pushed, if you like, by the problems at home, including terrible economy, violence in many cases, and of course, climate change. The migrants aren't the guilty ones here, but they're certainly paying the price.
Leonard, tell us what you saw when you visited some of those migrant detention centers in Libya. What did you see? And we are assuming there was some positive spin for you visitors.
There's no question. I went with the Director General of IOM, and it was a brief visit, and it was effectively a Potemkin village. This was like a front where they all had a nice sandwich in their hands and a bottle of cold water, and they were sitting for hours cross-legged out in the sun, women to one side, men to the other, and they were appealing and crying and begging to be brought out of this conditions that they're in. And then you look inside the detention center, so even though it had been spruced up for our visit, the place is a fetid room. There's one toilet for hundreds and hundreds of people. So it's not a nice place, and this is not what these migrants expected when they left home by any means. But they are very much the forgotten wretched of the earth. There's not a lot of attention being paid for them, except finally now attempts are being made to bring them home. But that's just part of the solution. They need to find a livelihood and a future when they get home, because they go home with debts and they go home in some shame.
Leonard Doyle with the International Organization for Migration there. Migration is also the driving force in our next story. The main character came to Italy from Nigeria nearly 20 years ago and has taken almost all that time for her to find peace and security in her new country. Caterina Fernandez-Martins reports from the Italian city of Caserta.
When Pet's father died and her family didn't have enough money to survive in Nigeria, friends told her about a job taking care of children in Florence. She signed up, but there was no job. She was sold to a trafficking ring.
Getting here, I was forced to go on to the road work, selling my body just to get money for them.
Pat, we are not using her last name to protect her identity, managed to escape. But since she owed thousands of dollars, her traffickers went after her family back in Nigeria.
They beat my younger sister. After some time, she passed away.
All this happened back in 2000. Pat fled Florence and settled in the south of Italy. But she struggled to support herself because she wasn't documented.
The first job that I have was a cleaning job at a company. The police people came to control, so I was forced to stop.
The area around Caserta and Castelvolturno, where Pat lives, is home to one of the biggest African communities in Italy. An estimated 5,000 to 6,000 undocumented migrants live and work here. Sympathy for migrants is wearing thin in Italy. While the number of arrivals has slowed in recent months, the country struggles to accommodate the hundreds of thousands who have entered the country in the last 20 years, while new asylum seekers arrive every month. migrants living in the south are especially vulnerable to being exploited because of the Camorra, the notorious mafia organization based in Naples.
Okay, guys, we start the meeting. Come on, everybody.
But they are also growing increasingly aware of their rights and their power to help each other fight for fair treatment.
This time we have plenty of new people, I think.
On a Monday afternoon, the staff of the Refugees and Asylum Seekers movement in Caserta welcomes new members among a crowd of mostly African migrants who are gathered for a weekly meeting.
Mon frère,
presentati. One of the key things this movement does is to help undocumented workers, like Pat, obtain papers that allow them to live and work legally.
They made them to know their right. They stand for human right.
My brother, the meeting starts at 6, huh? 6, no African time.
The people in this room are mostly economic migrants, not refugees from war. Refugees can win asylum, but migrants are usually denied permission to stay in Italy. The movement in Caserta wanted to change that. It came up with an original way of dealing with the issue by making the case that Italy is leaving these people vulnerable. Maria Rita Cardillo, an Italian activist with the movement, explains it doesn't have to always be about asylum. It can be about protezione umanitaria, humanitarian protection.
Is there some protection that you can give to those people that are vulnerable for something? Because they are without documents, they can be exploited in different kind of job.
Using this argument, the movement has been able to persuade the authorities it's better for everybody if you give these long-term undocumented workers papers.
We showed them that the people that get documents, they can change their own life. They can go to the school, they can come back in your country to see the family. They can have job with contract.
The movement has secured papers for more than 1,000 migrants this way, including Pat.
For the first fight for you to have a document, put you in Italian school, make sure that you have a work, you have a good life, you have a good place to sleep. Many people describe them as an organization. I call it a home of family because they bring hope to those who are hopeless.
The first thing she did when she got her residency last year was to go back and visit her family in Nigeria for the first time in 17 years. Just being free to come and go was a huge relief. But residency is not the same as citizenship, and that was still out of reach. But since then, Pat's life has taken another unexpected turn, one that has put her on the path to citizenship.
I tell Lameke, let me wash the plate for kitchen. Hey, ciao.
Hey.
When she was still undocumented, Pat took care of an Italian man who was sick and eventually passed away. During that time, she became like a member of the family.
Okay.
The man's brother, Ricciardo Amedeo, wanted to show his gratitude and offered her a place to stay at his house. Pat has been living there ever since, and she doesn't need to worry about paying rent or expenses. Recently, Amedeo decided to help some more. He offered to adopt Pat to help her get the citizenship and feel more secure.
Last year, you just told me, I want you to be secure here and I want you to have your document, that nobody is going to disturb you. So he said, okay, I asked him, how are you going to do it? He said, oh, let me call my lawyer. Let me see if I can go for adoption so that you can have Italian citizenship.
Che fatto?
Niente, io ho mangiato. Lei è uscita, è andata a fare un servizio, non so.
Amedeo is 71. He says that in addition to getting Pat the Italian citizenship, the adoption process is a way to show the neighbors the relationship is familial but not romantic.
Allora, che ha fatto oggi di lavoro in novità?
Pat and Ricciardo keep each other company and take turns with house chores to accommodate Pat's busy life.
Anche se in un certo qual senso trascura un poco la casa, la cura della casa, però dico non fa niente.
Look, even if she doesn't always take care of the house, I say to her, we'll find a solution. Like today, I got back from work and I cooked for myself and I took care of my things because I knew she had something else to do.
Now, Pat has settled into her new life. She has also started working with the Refugees and Asylum Seekers movement, the group that helped her with her papers.
Però mi ha detto alle tre, io sto qua prima di alle tre, mi sono preso un po' di freddo.
She accompanies fellow migrants, taking them to supermarkets like this one, helping with language and budgeting. She's perfect for this, bossy but also caring. She also helps them with court appointments and mediating disputes with the police.
And I love what I'm doing because I do help people like me. I'm very proud to help, so that's the way people help me.
Through her work in the movement in Caserta and her relationship with Ricciardi, Pat found a home in Italy.
I really can't explain. I know that I was praying to God that I need the help. God should send somebody to help me. I'm really happy now because I can see the changes of my life now.
For the world, Caterina Fernandes Martins, Caserta, Italy.
So what to make of the new somewhat friendly relations between North and South Korea around the Olympics? With just a couple of minutes before the break, we've got some useful insight from a former North Korean spy. And not just any spy. Kim Hyun-hui was one of two North Korean agents who, in 1988, you might recall, placed the bomb on a Korean Airlines jet that killed all 115 passengers, all South Koreans. That was in the run-up to the Summer Olympics that year in Seoul. Kim herself was not on the plane. She was later arrested by South Korean officials and sentenced to death. But eventually, a judge ruled she'd been brainwashed by the North Korean regime, and she was pardoned. Today, she still lives in South Korea. The BBC's correspondent in Seoul, Laura Bicker, spoke with Kim recently, and this former spy had this warning. She thinks the regime in Pyongyang isn't serious about peace, and Kim says the North's overtures in the run-up to the Winter Olympics this month in the South are all just the same old propaganda.
In the North, we are taught that the South is a colony of America, poor and corrupt, that the U.S. is an aggressor. We are told they are the arch enemy and we cannot live under the same sky.
Do you think right now, the run-up to the Olympics, the overtures of peace coming from Kim Jong-un, do you think it's fake?
Of course it is fake. The ultimate goal of North Korea is to complete its nuclear program. They have nothing in their mind but nuclear weapons. North Korea will not change through dialogue. I believe only pressure will work on North Korea.
Kim also explained why she continues to speak out against Pyongyang nearly 30 years after her act of terrorism.
I believe it is my duty and the reason I am still alive to reveal the truth so that there is no other incident like this.
Former North Korean spy Kim Hyun-hui speaking in Seoul with the BBC's Laura Becker. Last summer, Haiti's Senate passed bills that, among other things, would outlaw public support for homosexuality. It's just the latest attack on LGBTQ people in Haiti. Activists there say homophobia has been on the rise since the devastating earthquake of 2010, but defenders of gay rights are not backing down. Amy Bracken has our story from Port-au-Prince.
The name of Haiti's most prominent LGBT rights organization is Courage, or Courage, with good reason. They've had to move their headquarters three times following attacks. Now it's unmarked with a plainclothes security guard out front. But inside, there's no question where you are. The reception area is decorated with a rainbow flag and a rainbow clock. And behind the front desk sits a young transgender woman with a warm smile. Smichina Charles is a Courage receptionist and a human rights trainer. She tells me that last year, life in Haiti got more dangerous.
There are two propositions of law recent that came to the Parliament.
She says it's because of legislation that passed Haiti's Senate last summer. The bills, among other things, would ban, quote, public demonstrations of support for homosexuality and would make just attending a same-sex wedding punishable by 3 years in prison and a big fine. Never mind that gay marriage already isn't legal in Haiti. Neither measure has become law. And yet, Charles says, people thought they did, and that's had an impact.
Toutes les rumeurs. Toutes les médias nationales, yo di ke gen on loi ki vote kont ma sisi, kont ma divine nan peyi.
She says all the rumors, all the national media say there's a law that passed against gays and lesbians in the country, and people hearing that react by looking out for groups of gay people to attack. Of course, the bills didn't come out of nowhere, and Courage staff say Haiti's anti-LGBT climate has gotten worse since the 2010 earthquake. Chachou Jean-Francois, youth educator, says one reason is the arrival of foreign evangelicals imposing their views.
Yo pa ka fè la kayo, parce que la kayo côté que droit moun respecté.
They can't do this in their home countries where human rights are respected, so they come to underdeveloped countries where they make people believe homosexuality is something abominable.
After the earthquake, many of the organizations that rushed in to help were evangelical Christian groups. And it's widely believed in Haiti's LGBT community that as Christian fundamentalism spread, so did anti-gay sentiment. By contrast, Haiti's other major religion, voodoo, is seen as gay-friendly. But Charlot Jeudy, Courage's 34-year-old president, says there's another reason the climate feels more hostile.
Et effectivement, de plus en plus communauté invisible. Nous visible vraiment ces sept dernières années parce que
our community has grown increasingly visible over the last 7 years. Because we made a choice. We can't stay hidden any longer. We have a proverb in this country. If you say hello to the devil, he'll eat you. And if you don't say hello to the devil, he'll eat you. So we decided to say hello to the devil.
So in 2011, he created Courage, which in 2016 organized an LGBT film festival called Massimadi, from Creole terms for gay and lesbian. But before the festival could start, a senator condemned it, death threats poured in, and the government shut it down. And the public outcry helped inspire the introduction of the anti-gay legislation last year. Pastors and legislators who supported the bills did not return calls for comment, but I found plenty of voices of support just walking around the Champ de Mars, Port-au-Prince's Central Park.
Bonjour, madame.
Johnny Louis, a computer technician, tells me it's not homophobia that's imported.
There are a lot of things that the big Western countries want to impose on us. They want to impose on us women marrying women and men marrying men. We in Haiti are not ready for those things, and I don't think we'll ever accept it.
Oh, yeah, on pin.
A young woman named Lovely Jean-Baptiste says it's common for gay and lesbian people to be beaten up. And they are sometimes even killed because, she says, they shouldn't be doing that. Asked if she's okay with violence against gay people, she says,
oui.
Yes. The Courage office feels like a refuge from this harsh reality. Many of the young men and women here treat each other like family, and that's no accident. Some were abandoned by their parents when they came out. It's a sad situation, says Courage staffer Dominique Saint-Ville, but he chooses to focus on the positive.
Before they would stand against the parents and said, I'm an homosexual and I'm allowed to live my life. Or I'm an homosexual but I'm allowed to go to church. So nobody would do that before. But for me, these are really important steps. Of course, Haiti have a lot of hate towards the homosexual. But a lot of people are starting to see us as they should see us, as human beings, as citizens of the country.
Saint-Ville adds that a police officer recently threatened a Courage member with arrest for wearing a Massimadi Film Festival T-shirt, citing the non-existent law against public displays of homosexuality. But the officer let him go because the man in the T-shirt said he knew his rights and that Courage would defend him. For The World, Amy Bracken, Port-au-Prince.
Amy's story was produced in collaboration with Round Earth Media. So yesterday we told you about a singer who was featured recently on the French version of the TV show The Voice. I began by saying I'm always intrigued how American TV series play out overseas. Well, a listener wrote us to point out that, sorry, The Voice in France doesn't really qualify because we Americans got the idea from the Dutch show The Voice of Holland. Fair call. Franchising pop culture, it's one thing. Appropriating culture is another. The French band Ifriqiya Electrique went to Tunisia to collaborate with traditional musicians in the Banga community there. Those are descendants of enslaved Africans brought to the Barbary Coast hundreds of years ago from what is now Nigeria. François Cambouza with Ifriqiya Electrique told us the recording experience in Tunisia was electric, but he says the band tread carefully because this wasn't their music.
It was not planned to be released. It was a personal research.
So we went there. We lived with them for long, recording them and trying to rebuild everything with computer. So with really a time warp that is very, very, very sharp. And then to add long time after all the Western instruments. So what it is at the end, it's really like a techno or dub or rock actually. You know, you go to a rock concert or a punk concert and it's to bring everything out. You go to a techno party, well, you can take drugs or whatever you want, but it's about getting somewhere else, and then the band has this role. I don't know if it's right what we are doing to make it as a show. We ask them. Of course, the first answer from them was, yeah, let's do it.
François Cambuzat with Ifriqiya Electrique there. And that will do it for us today. From the Nan and Bill Harris studios at WGBH, I'm Marco Werman. We'll see you back here tomorrow.
PRI, Public Radio International.